Last week, we talked about Steven Soderbergh's Schizopolis, a movie that might have looked to some outsiders like a career suicide note, but that was, in fact, a highly personal, creative rebirth, and is a lot better than its reputation. Schizopolis had its U.S. release on April 9th, 1997, but on March 19th, only 3 weeks before it failed to make a meaningful impression on the film-going public, Soderbergh actually released another film that also failed to find an audience, Grey's Anatomy, a kind of concert film for monologuist Spalding Gray. This is a little bit of an anomaly in that it's neither a dramatic feature nor a documentary that Soderbergh directed, so we're going to cover it.
Yeah, and if you want, you consider this a bonus episode. There may be more of these ahead, covering more of Soderbergh's non-feature film projects. There's the TV series, documentaries, and well, let's not forget about his first significant commercial achievement, 90210 Live. I love that title. And I also love that it's a concert film for the prog rock band Yes.
Dr. Mendel, please, what is wrong with my left eye? Tell me.
Basically, Gary, you have a macula pucker.
Macula pucker? What is that, Dr. Mendel?
Basically, what's happened is that your vitreal gel is broken down or decomposed in your left eye and pulled away from the macula, which is center of the retina and responsible for all detail and vision. Now, the breakdown of the vitreal gel is not that uncommon. We find in most autopsies that the cadaver no longer has a vitreal gel. In your case, you are less fortunate because in pulling away from the macula, it left a little piece of tissue and has caused your macula to pucker up. I mean, think of your retina as a piece of saran wrap bunching. You have a pucker, Gary, a pucker.
But what would cause that? I can't possibly, I don't have it happen to my right eye. I mean, what would cause a thing like that?
I don't know. Do you have any trauma to that left eye?
I can't think of any. I mean, the last thing I can remember happened to my left eye was so long ago. It was 1976, I remember. It was a New Year's Eve. I was dancing with this woman. She didn't have a very good sense of her own personal space, if you know what I mean. And her pinky shot into my left eye, and she scratched my cornea. It was tearing. It was painful. They put a patch over it. He just turns to me and says, "You have a good memory, don't you, Gary? But is there anything that could be, you know, be done for the left eye? Any corrective measures?"
"Yes, I think so. I recommend a little macula scraping."
Anyway, yes, this will be a shorter episode unless we suddenly become infected with Spalding Gray's ability to turn the smallest occurrence into an evening-long speech. For younger listeners who may not know, Gray was the baby boomer's David Sedaris, a humorous essayist and monologuist, but with a key difference in that he did some acting. Gray was very much a WASP by birth and upbringing, but culturally, was a neurotic Jewish New Yorker. And it's not just me saying that. Jewish critics at the time said the same thing. Picture, oh, I don't know, Whit Stillman growing up wanting to be Woody Allen. Deep cut for the film nerds there. Gray's signature monologues, which he delivered seated at a table with only a microphone, a notebook, and a glass of water, were certainly influential on today's boom in spoken word performance and live storytelling. It's hard to picture This American Life or the Moth Radio Hour without him.
Gray broke out with an excellent Jonathan Demme-directed theatrical film of his monologue, Swimming to Cambodia, which was based on Gray's experience acting in Roland Joffé's The Killing Fields. He followed that up with two more, Monster in a Box and Terrors of Pleasure. Soderbergh's interest in Gray began when he saw Swimming to Cambodia on VHS sometime after its 1987 release. As he later told film critic Amy Tobin, he thought, "Oh, my mind works like that too. I identified with the struggle to filter experience so that it seems to make sense, which is an ongoing, sometimes futile process. To watch someone describe that struggle so well and with such humor and detail was intoxicating."
Soderbergh did a deep dive on Gray and read everything he'd published, including his novel, Impossible Vacation, which was published in 1992. And in that novel, Gray explored his mother's real-life suicide. Soderbergh wanted to work with him, so he cast him in King of the Hill as Mr. Mungo, a depressed man who eventually kills himself.
We actually spoiled that in episode 3 of this podcast.
Tragically, Gray would kill himself in real life on January 11th, 2004, by jumping into New York Harbor. And that could be a subject of an entire podcast episode. Soderbergh doesn't remember if it was his idea to turn Gray's Anatomy into a film, or if it was suggested to him by Kathleen Russo, Gray's partner at the time, who later became his wife. But at any rate, Gray's Anatomy was shot over 10 days in January 1996, while Soderbergh was taking a break from post-production on Schizopolis. Soderbergh did not operate the camera or edit the film, although his usual collaborator, Cliff Martinez, did do the score.
There's an interesting piece of trivia here in that Gray was a founding member of the Wooster Group, an experimental theater company, and he founded it with Ron Vaughter, who plays the therapist in Sex, Lies, and Videotape and the hotel manager in King of the Hill. And another founding member, Willem Dafoe.
Oh my God.
Oh, what a group.
I want to read more about the Wooster Group.
Yeah, I maybe that's another bonus episode.
That could be. And if I'm not mistaken, it's not like Wooster, Rhode Island. I think it's like Wooster Street in like lower Manhattan or something.
Oh, yeah, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was wondering, why do all these people come from? Anyway.
Yeah. Well, hey, whatever it is, that's where Gray's monologues began to take shape.
A more disturbing piece of trivia is that Gray acted in two porno films during the 1970s. Even worse, under circumstances I choose not to disclose, I saw one of them called Maraschino Cherry. And at the time, I remember thinking, hey, that guy looks like Spalding Gray. And I just thought it was a weird coincidence. Now I know the truth, and I am so disturbed, Mike. It's like seeing your parents have sex
and talking a lot during. Oh, like I haven't seen these movies. I want to. Although maybe not, because in my head I imagine Gray like monologuing through the whole thing. He's like, you know, and then I was caressing her breasts, and I thought to myself, should I be examining her breasts? Should I examine my breasts? Do males get breast cancer? Oh god.
Yeah,
Spalding Gray.
Pretty good.
Yeah,
the reality was not like nearly that impressive. But yeah, you should not under any circumstances see these films. But that would have actually been a much more interesting Spalding Gray monologue, I think, than any one he ever did would have been, like for him to talk about his experience making low budget 1970s porno films. He could have collaborated with Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh man, Boogie Nights 2.
Or just a stage monologue directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. I'd like to.
Yeah, if you can put those together somehow.
Somehow.
I think there's
a missed opportunity, sadly.
Yeah, unfortunately, tragically, yes.
Moving along, this time, just for fun, both Mike and I will offer one sentence summaries of Grey's Anatomy. Here's what I've got. Self-involved monologuist Spalding Gray risks losing the ability to gaze at his own navel when he develops an esoteric eye condition and pursues increasingly non-traditional treatments until a chance encounter with Richard Nixon convinces him to rely on conventional medicine.
You know, I expected a much less cheeky summary from you. We'll get into our feelings about the movie, which are not similar.
They do diverge somewhat.
They do diverge. Mine's simple. A neurotic man privileged with limitless resources does everything he can to avoid outpatient surgery.
I mean, that's good. That is on point. That is on point. So, Roger, I mean, Mike, what did you think?
Well, Gene, you know, okay. So via text, we were discussing this a little, and I think I sounded harsher than I felt about it. Really, what this movie comes down to, and I think anybody would agree, it's your mileage of Spalding Gray.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I appreciate Gray, and I really respect what he's done, and I like what he does to a certain degree. But he's also not somebody I want to spend 90 uninterrupted minutes with.
Fair. I once wrote a book review of a nonfiction book in which I sort of made a similar point, sort of saying like the book itself is interesting, but your mileage on this book will vary depending on how much you like the author. And received a really angry anonymous email. I wonder who that was from after that review came out. And later I realized that was probably harsh, but there it is true. Like with this format, you know, how whatever we think of Steven Soderbergh's filmic treatment of this, and we'll get into that. First, we're talking about Spalding Gray. But your experience of this film, there's no way around it, is going to be colored on how much you can stand Spalding Gray.
Yeah.
The first few times I saw Spalding Gray films, I liked him a lot. Like at the time, like I thought he was really interesting. I mean, I was raised watching Woody Allen films, you know, like full confession here. My dad was a huge Woody Allen fan. I grew up watching Woody Allen films. From the early slapstick comedies to the you know, later better dramas, and whatever we may think of Woody Allen now and his films, like that very much informed my sensibility. And so I was very, as a young adult, I was very prepared to sit in the audience and listen to this neurotic guy talk about himself. And I found it very funny, and I liked it. Watching it again at the beginning of the movie, for the first 15 or 20 minutes, I was kind of having, I think, more of your reaction, where I was kind of like cringing and retreating into my chair. Not that there was that much give in the upholstery. I just was kind of like, I felt so dated. He felt so self-involved. Even his hair was kind of like this embarrassing, like dude compensating with shoulder length hair. But it started to work for me. And as the film went by, I began to like it. That didn't happen for you.
No, not really. I guess I did warm to him a little bit, but I guess what ultimately would prevent me, Gene, from giving this a thumbs up would be, I don't think that he stuck the landing. Like I was hoping as I was watching this, boy, do I hope he really brings us to a really interesting place at the end of this. And the funny thing is, and I'm sure you do as well, like I know people like this. I know people like this guy who will come and they'll talk to you about their stuff, and they're ruled by their neuroses. You know,
yes.
Whatever is happening right now is the most important, pressing thing, and will be for weeks. You know,
yeah,
that's Spalding Gray's shit. That's what he does. That's he dives deep into his neuroses and his self and all this stuff. But the problem for me is that narratively, like the payoff wasn't there. Like I want to say he didn't learn anything, because I feel like he has this soft point of like, you know, it all the world is depending on your point of view and how you look at things. You know, he kind of comes there, but at the same time, like people like that, from my experience, are kind of incapable of learning, because like I said, they're so ruled by their neurotic, you know, obsessions,
yeah,
that is what they kind of come to be. So learning isn't really, there's not a lot of learning going on, you know? And we got to the end, I'm like, did this guy learn a single thing?
That's a really excellent point that honestly hadn't occurred to me in that way. And I think you're right. I do think that the structure of it suffers because the ending is... When you watch a great monologue, when you hear a great live story, a lot of times Moth Radio Hour, which I generally like, but can start to feel a little repetitive or something. You know, somebody tells a 20-minute story and you just feel like, and then it suddenly is over and you're just like, oh, okay. It was a fun story, but they didn't know how to restructure it, and that there was a real payoff. And then you listen to a great one and somehow something creeps up. It's the way any movie should be structured, really. Like great endings should feel surprising yet inevitable.
Exactly.
And that's the hardest thing to pull off. And I would agree that Gray does not pull that off. What did work for me is that I started getting carried along on his ludicrous journeys to try to heal this macular pucker, this problem he has with his eye. The adult me is sitting there judging him the whole time, saying, dude, just follow the doctor's advice.
Yes.
But the me who loves weirdo eccentric people is sort of fascinated by the lengths he goes to avoid just a normal outpatient procedure.
Right, because he's like waiting in like, I did my own research territory.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he goes to see a psychic surgeon in the Philippines, which, I mean, Andy Kaufman did it. Didn't work for him either. He's a complete idiot about that stuff. And I also wonder how much of that is literally true. That did he really do all these things? He probably did a sweat lodge. Did he really go to the Philippines? I hope he did.
That's a great question.
Because I am fat. Yeah, and I didn't have time to go down the rabbit hole. I know that he is one of those people who says that my monologues are emotionally true. So I think, like a lot of people, and I think even Sedaris, like, I believe they'll kind of shade things or invent minor facts to make their story stronger. So I'm hoping he didn't invent an entire trip to the Philippines. If so, I would say we got to call bullshit on this story. But I do like, I was very entertained by his obsession, even though I think he was being a complete idiot. I say this as somebody who's had 3 corneal surgeries and didn't do any research. I accepted my surgeon's recommendations and it worked out great.
You know, it's funny. I have also had eye surgeries. I lost my vision in my left eye when I was young. Well, it's a long story. We both are candidates, the interstitials. We could have been in the movie.
Absolutely. I would say that we have a perspective on this that a lot of viewers wouldn't have. And we're both here to say that, don't go see a weird nutritional healer on Long Island.
No.
If your eye doctor diagnoses you with macular pucker.
Yeah, just for God's sakes, just get the surgery.
So he's self-involved. He's somewhat irritating. I did get swept away. And a lot of that, I would say, is due to Soderbergh's artistry, mm-hmm. which I'll say in one moment. But one other thing I'm going to add, and I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, but my 17-year-old son, Cosmo, watched it with me and loved it. And that really surprised me because I thought it would seem much more dated and, you know, who is this old self-involved guy? And Cosmo's take on it was kind of like, I think he appreciated the storytelling. I think he was entertained by the bizarre lengths this guy went to and the way he could kind of retell those experiences. And I believe he also really liked Soderbergh's craft. I thought it was fascinating that somebody who's had never heard of Spalding Gray until this came up could actually be swayed by it. So, you know, there's an audience for it.
Yeah, I mean, I am fascinated by that. When you told me that, I was very surprised, you know? But then I thought about it. I'm like, man, Spalding Gray would kill it on TikTok. You know,
probably. Yeah, absolutely. Right. He was the godfather of self-involved people.
Yeah. I mean, that's really, right. That's what social media is.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what Soderbergh brings to the picture, which is a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I will say, like, for everything that's, you know, that I look at and I was, you know, grumpy about and didn't enjoy with Spalding Gray, like, Soderbergh did some really cool stuff in here. Like, I liked his use of light and color. I liked, there was some really good cutting, really good scenery that he did. From my understanding, I've never seen the Jonathan Demme Swimming to Cambodia, yeah. Which I should, because I love his Talking Heads movie. He's obviously very, very skilled at this type of film. But from what I understand, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's just Spalding Gray just sitting at the table. I'm like, that's it, right?
It's, well, it captures the live experience more because it is filmed in front of an audience.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's really well done. It's very enjoyable. It's probably a little more, I don't know, it's like an enhanced live performance.
Okay.
Whereas Soderbergh makes a really interesting choice in that he films a live performance without an audience.
Which is interesting.
It's very Soderbergian, I would say. He's like, I'm going to make a concert film without an audience because, you know, that's been done. And yeah. I think probably the right artistic choice because why try to out Demi? Demi already made a really well-received live version of Swimming to Cambodia with some theatrical effects for sure, but it's more subtle. I thought there were so many interesting ads by Soderbergh here. I mean, the whole thing starts with like 10 minutes of man on the street interviews about people who have had eye injuries, eye surgery, eye problems.
Where do you find those people?
I don't know. There's one guy who's like standing in front of some sort of burning trash pile or oil refinery or something. I don't know what. There's thick black smoke billowing up behind him. What is this story?
Yeah, so do you got to go to attend to that?
Yeah, right. Like, you need to go put that fire out? But I thought that was a really fun indie thing because those are also black and white.
Yeah,
it just felt
really cool.
This is Soderbergh coming right out of filming Schizopolis. And so he's being indie and creative and off the beaten path. And then he also really disrupts the whole concert experience by putting Spalding Gray in different sets that aren't super literal representations, but kind of capture the vibe of the places he's talking about, like being inside a sweat lodge or something. Or at times he's got Gray's chair on a dolly and it's just like moving him across the screen, or he's doing a lot of work with light and perspective to capture the feelings that Gray is evoking. And I found it to be pretty effective.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what's interesting, you said this in our first episode, I believe, where we were talking about the Yes documentary, and you talked about how he made like a cheeky cut, a joking cut, or whatever you want to call it, where he was like, this is the fun, weird cut that I'm going to do. And they're obviously going to reject it and I'll go back and play it straight, you know? And I feel like this is just that an extension of that mentality, because like Soderbergh, I feel like is a director who's always going to look at something and say, what is the thing about this that interests me?
Yes.
Like me personally, what am I going to do that's going to capture my attention? Because I think his attention span obviously is robust because he does so much and he has a lot of different varied interests. So he's got to find that thing that's going to make him engaged, you know, on that artistic level. I think he's obviously, you know, enjoys Spalding Gray's work, and I think he was clearly engaged on that level.
Yeah.
But there's this guy that's something else, and he really brought that something else. Like you said, there's cool movement. He really set the emotion. He set the tone. He wasn't on the nose with what he was doing, but it was clever. And now knowing how Swinging Cambodia worked, which, by the way, dear listener, for context, I would go back and watch this kind of movies, but like 90 minutes of Gray, I was like, I'm good.
For that reason, I'm out.
So I did not watch. So I should have, to be fully vetted.
Falling down on the job.
I know. But knowing that, how that functioned, this is really a cool take.
Yeah. And I will say that I probably would have liked this film less if not for Soderbergh's treatment of it, because I think it would have been a little too much Spalding Gray.
Agreed.
I think it kind of offers some relief from the kind of intensity. And the story of this is not as, in my recollection, because I haven't rewatched Swimming in Cambodia recently, but in my recollection, this monologue is not as great as the Swimming to Cambodia monologue. So that's another.
Okay. Well, that makes sense then. I mean, I feel like also I am curious, and maybe this is a testament to Spalding Gray. Despite everything I've said, I am interested in giving it another go. Maybe not on the same day. But I would be interested in seeing Swimming to Cambodia, also because I like Demi so much and I want to see what he does. I would watch another one.
You should definitely watch Swimming to Cambodia. And I felt like this film kind of, you know, I didn't think it was perfect. There were times when I got a little tired of Gray, but overall I found it an enjoyable watching experience. Typically, I will watch the films we're discussing, you know, two or three times, you know, immediately before we record. I did not do that, so I think that tells us something. But I have found myself thinking about it a lot. However, the things I think about most are not the story, but the filmic treatment of it.
Good thing we're here for this podcast.
So we'd better cut this short if we don't want to give Spalding Gray a run for his money in terms of length. However, we'll be back in a moment. And when we come back, we'll answer this question. Was this Soderbergh's biggest bomb yet?
Cringe.
It was about 10 years ago. I was doing a brake job on my pickup truck, and I was cleaning the backing plate, and I had it up on blocks and had the wheels and everything torn apart, and I was cleaning the backing plate with a wire brush on an air tool, and there was one spot left about a size of a quarter, and the only way I could see it was to look around to the side, and it was throwing dirt back on me. So I thought about getting some safety glasses, but then I thought, nah, it's only size of a quarter, I'll finish it right away. So I stuck the tool back in, and sure enough, a little dirt in the eye. So I went into my trailer, I went into the went to the bathroom, I looked in the mirror, and I looked and opened my eye up like this, and sure enough, a bullseye, a piece of wire sticking straight in the eye. And I tried to grab it with my finger, and it was too short, so I went outside and got my pliers wiped the grease off, came in, grabbed hold of him, and I started pulling, and the eye was stretching out. And I thought, well, I don't know what I should do, but if I go see a doctor, it's got to come out. They have to take it out. So I grabbed it again with the pliers and pulled it out. And when I did, it tore a hole in the eye, and the front sack of the eye drained all the fluid out, and I was blinded in one eye. And the worst part was I had to finish the brake job with one eye 2.5 hours so I could go drive into town and see a doctor.
And we're back. Mike, how did the critics respond to Grey's Anatomy?
They were kind of hit and miss, a mixed bag, it felt like, from what I was able to see. I did pull some interesting snippets. The first one is from Janet Maslin of the New York Times. She was mixed, almost positive, I think you can say. But of Soderbergh specifically, she wrote, "This direction is more ambitious than apt, since it calls attention to the artifice that Mr. Grey otherwise conceals so well. Cuts and scene changes become distractingly blunt, as due to the star's efforts to suggest some spontaneous enthusiasm. And as a form of commentary on the monologue itself, Mr. Soderbergh's emphasis on all things visual is so self-evident that it adds little. A handsomely photographed 10-minute prologue in an 80-minute film featuring other speakers with eye problems feels more like padding than illumination."
So, interesting take. You know, I disagree with a fair amount of that, but like, yeah, it's the thing that she sees as a bug is almost the thing that I see as a feature, like trying to visually illustrate the visual aspects.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that he's trying to find a way, and this is what, the third monologue film? We talk about Demi's, but there's another one, at least one more in between.
There's four in all, Terrors of Pleasure and Monster in a Box.
I think they're all before. So this might be the fourth.
I think this is the fourth one.
Film. I mean, you got to do something, you know? I mean, so yeah, it's an interesting attempt. Washington Post was positive. They said it's a dizzying, absorbing odyssey of the neurotic mind, which is
fair.
Yeah. I felt dizzy. The Tribune was negative, demonstrates that fully stimulating the senses isn't the same as fully engaging them, says Mark Caro.
That's funny. I've gotten to know Mark in recent years, and as I'm doing a lot of this research, he was doing a ton of film reviews for The Trib at the time, and so I keep coming across his reviews.
Yeah, this is pre-Michael Phillips then.
He was somewhat at the same time, like Mark was kind of the additional film critic. But,
I see.
Or Mike Wilmington, I think, was the main guy at the time. And Carol was a general arts and entertainment reporter. So he did a fair amount of film as well.
Okay. And it's Michael Phillips full time now, correct?
I think that's right.
Yeah, I think so. Yes. Anyway, last bit I have here was Variety, who liked it. And they said the most elaborately cinematic of Grey's three monologue films.
True.
Yeah. So that's good. The problem, I think, and I even hesitate to say the word problem, but there's not a ton of reviews of it. It just wasn't, as you mentioned before, wasn't really widely seen, wasn't widely reviewed. It feels like a movie continuing Soderbergh's trend that came and went.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So the critics didn't love it. How about the people who actually pay for their tickets?
I didn't ask all of them. I could have.
Straw poll.
So it earned only $29,000. Let me say that again, slowly. $29,000. Five figures on a budget of $350,000, which is surprising. I'm surprised it's actually that high. I'm very curious about that. That's like $100,000 more than Schizopolis. Wow. That's a high budget.
Well, you bring the name Spalding Gray in, and they're going to start throwing money around.
How much did he make? Goodness.
Okay, so $29,000 earned back from $350,000. Ouch. Surely that's Soderbergh's biggest financial failure?
Well, hold on. Let me remind you that Schizopolis only made $10,580 on a budget of, like I just said, $250,000.
So wait. That's...
No. Look, okay. So I know you love to crunch numbers. This time I did it ahead of time. Grey's Anatomy only earned back 8.31% of what it cost. Schizopolis, 4.23% of what it cost.
Let's have a moment of silence for Steven Soderbergh's career, which is clearly over.
Yeah. Well, this podcast was fun. The end.
Well, it's been nice.
Well, wait. Things are going to get better next week. A whole lot better.
Phew. Okay. Let's take another quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about how everything changed when Soderbergh decided to swap muses, ditching Spalding Gray for George Clooney. Here, if someone's coming to Chicago, what's one place they should visit?
Well, I would say Calumet Fisheries, but that burned down. You can still see the famous bridge where the Blues Brothers jumped over the Calumet River, though. Maybe the Rat Hole in Roscoe Village, where you can see the outline of a rat that died in the wet cement when they were pouring a sidewalk.
Okay, I take it you're not a fan of the usual tourist stuff. No Navy Pier, Sky Deck, Bean, Pizzeria Uno, nothing?
Well, everybody knows about those. Actually, there is one Chicago landmark no visitor should miss.
Which is?
Exile in Bookville, Chicago's most Instagrammable bookstore. The name is a tribute to the classic Liz Phair album, Exile in Guyville. I can't wait until someone names a bookstore after us.
You're right, Pierre. Exile is the best. Wall to wall, floor to ceiling books, all lovingly curated by owners Javier Ramirez and Kristen Enola Gilbert. Even if you don't know what you're looking for, I guarantee you'll find something to read. Their recommendations are always on point.
Their strong suit may be general and literary fiction, but I particularly love the middle room. That's where you find books about art and music, graphic novels, cooking and cocktails, and the filmographer's personal favorite, film books.
Like the store itself, it's small but lovingly curated. Javier and Kristen were kind enough to let us recommend our favorite film books, so stop by and see.
I wrote a shelf talker for one of my all-time favorites, Kyle Buchanan's Blood, Sweat, and Chrome, the wild and true story of Mad Max Fury Road. Everyone who worked on that movie is a legitimate hero.
They also stocked one of my favorites, Sam Wasson's The Big Goodbye, Chinatown and the Last Years of Hollywood. Exile also has the best small press selection I've ever seen. Weird books, but good books. Oh, and the best in modern horror.
Don't forget the pens and stationery.
Oh, I won't. I actually just got a Miyazaki-themed journal for my kids.
They also have some of the most interesting author events around. From their horror book club and their film club to big-name visiting authors, there's always something cool going on there.
You said it, Kier. Listeners, if you're coming to Chicago, don't leave without visiting Exile in Bookville on the second floor of the beautiful historic fine arts building at 410 South Michigan Avenue. That's exileinbookville.com and at Exile in Bookville on Instagram.
Because there's more to life than movies. There are books, too.
About movies.
And we're back. Mike, is there any deeper connection to Soderbergh's career here? Or is this just a gig he picked up at a time he needed it?
Well, as we said last week when we discussed Schizopolis, this is a difficult time in his life and his career. He was going through a divorce, a number of films had failed, they bombed at the box office, bad critical reception, and sometimes they even struggled to get distribution. His creative malaise seemed to bottom out during the making of The Underneath, and then he was in the process of putting himself back together with Schizopolis when he shot Grey's Anatomy, which I would argue is it's more of a Spalding Gray film than a Steven Soderbergh film. Mm-hmm. But let me read you this. This is interesting. In a 1996 interview with Independent Film and Video Monthly, when asked if independent cinema was running off course due to all the big time money that's being pumped into them and they're earning, but they're being pumped in through places like Miramax, who are owned by Disney at this point, Gramercy and Fox Searchlight. Soderbergh said this: "I don't worry about interesting films getting made. I worry about how they're going to get seen. Because as the stakes get higher and higher, it gets more and more expensive to release a movie. The distributors are going to be less willing to take a risk." It was a summer toting Grey's Anatomy and Schizopolis around and have everyone say, "I don't think we can make this work." We had one company say, We ran the numbers and we decided that we actually could turn a profit with this film, but not enough of a profit to make it worth our while.
Ooh.
And I thought, gee, if you could say that about all 12 films you released this year, that's a good year. But now it's changed. Getting a movie made is only half of it. So what's interesting is that this feels like Hallmark Soderbergh, you know, just always examining and questioning the Hollywood landscape. And just, he has this remarkable vision where he's seeing what's going on and he knows independent isn't independent at all. You know, like I said, this is Fox and it's Gramercy and it's Miramax via Disney. You know, it's just not independent. And he's seeing, you know, where is my role within it? Now, despite that, thinking of his role within independent cinema and the movement of which, you know, he was the tip of the spear, has it passed him by, Kier?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I love, you've said this on a number of different occasions, this one we've been talking, and I think you're so right. He's such a clear-eyed observer, not only of his own work, but of the scene. He has no illusions about things. But I do think, like, it's still possible to kind of discuss the indie film movement as the indie film movement, just because that's what people collectively believe it to be. Mm-hmm. So even if they're not truly independent films, this was what was happening at the time he's making these movies. And the directors that were inspired by him or that rode along in his coattails or that were given opportunities based on the space he created with Sex, Lies, and Videotape are suddenly the hot it kids, and he's scuffling around doing these films that are losing, I was gonna say tons of money, but they're not actually losing that much money by Hollywood standards. It's just percentage-wise, they're losing a lot of money.
Right, and he's getting less money to work with, so
yeah,
less to lose.
But I would say that, interestingly, you could argue that he has completely reestablished his indie bona fides with Schizopolis, even though it wasn't widely recognized at the time, mm-hmm. because his peers were starting to achieve greater success and starting to make bigger, glossier, better financed pictures. And he actually went back to his hometown and is running around with a camera and his friends making a freaking independent film. And the fact that it didn't achieve wide recognition or wide, I mean, there's no more punk rock cred than that.
It's true. That's true.
And then too, I would argue that Grey's Anatomy, even though you're completely right that it's more of a Grey film, is a minor but meaningful step in Soderbergh's development. I mean, partly it's an example of, as if we didn't already have enough examples of the diversity that characterizes his career, right?
Yeah.
It's the seriousness that he takes, with which he takes a visual task. He doesn't just say, well, I'm gonna set up a few camera angles and just shoot this guy and cash a check. He gets really involved in the process. He really thinks through, how can I best represent what's going on in this weirdo's brain for film audiences? How can I make this something that's different, instead of just sort of saying, oh, it's a concert film, you know, you're sitting in a theater instead of a concert hall. No, he's trying to actually make a freaking movie out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can add on to that, you know, someone who's, you know, worked on film sets, directed a movie. It also goes to like his remarkable efficiency, because this is shot like 10 days or 8 days. I think we saw both, but a short amount of time it was shot on.
Yeah.
The most time consuming thing when making a movie are setups. Like, you have to relight, you have to move the camera. Like, I don't think people like appreciate or realize that, like, every time you have to go put the camera anywhere else, you got to start it all over. You're relighting and you're redoing the whole thing. He had a lot of setups in this movie. I mean, moving the camera, all the things that you mentioned, like, that all takes a lot of time. It may not look like it because it's just a guy sitting at a table. It doesn't matter. What matters is like the camera setups and movement and lighting and et cetera, and then bringing the color and all that stuff. That's time consuming. Like, that he did this so quickly is kind of crazy.
I mean, absolutely. He made a ton of work for himself. And those Man on the Street interviews in the first 10 minutes that Maslin says is padding. Like, how is it padding if you go out, find these subjects, right, film them in situ, like in their unique, weird locations? I mean, that's work. That's not padding. That's not just like, well, let's let the camera run.
Yeah, it wasn't like B-roll or B footage of like just the outtakes or something like that. That was like, yeah, narratively driven to be part of the film experience itself and enhance Spalding Gray's, what he's saying, and also enhance the movie itself visually and cinematically. So no, it's not padding.
Yeah, and the Man on the Street interviews too just add, as we said already, that kind of fun indie sense of play. It's not something you expect. When the movie begins, I had actually forgotten about those. I'd seen this before, but I had kind of forgotten. And when those started, there's this moment of being puzzled because you're thinking, this is a movie about Spalding Gray. Spalding Gray is a monologuist who sits at a table with a microphone and a glass of water. Why is he not the first thing I'm seeing? So again, it's a filmmaking choice that really kind of activates your curiosity and kind of wakes you up.
With these things in mind, especially with that idea that we talked about, like, of Steven Soderbergh's vision, the clarity he has about his career, the clarity he has about the filmmaking business, the clarity he has about what's going on right now and what might be happening next. I want to ask you a question. Is this idea that this realization that he has of what is indie and not indie, does that inform his next filmmaking choice?
You know, that's such a fascinating question. And I have to believe that it does, because his next filmmaking choice, which I think Soderbergh fans are going to know exactly what we're talking about, but it's sort of like it almost feels like he's making a decision based on that wonderful quote you unearthed that, well, if there's no such thing as indie filmmaking, really, like the financing isn't this thing that we need to obsess about, what are we left with? Film is film. I'm going to bring me, Steven Soderbergh, to every project that I'm working on, and I'm going to bring the truest version of me, and I'm going to bring the tools that I have and apply them to the film as best I can. But every film needs different tools. And I think that Grey's Anatomy is a great example of that. It's a minor film, but an important stepping stone.
Yeah. And I think that, like, adding on to that, Soderbergh's craft is never in question. No matter what depths he found himself in, the craft and his ability were never in question. You know, like even, you know, King of the Hill, Kafka, they were all wonderfully made movies, but they just weren't, like we talk about Schizopolis, he was a man trying to connect, and they are movies that were failing to connect. So that wasn't the problem. But I think maybe there's this realization, and I don't want to assume to know his mind, but maybe there's a realization that, like, I don't need to be scuffling around. I don't need to be limited to, smaller-ish budgets. And I forget what the underneath was. It was pretty low. Schizopolis was very low.
Yeah.
Like, I can take my craft and I can bring it to something bigger and glossier and genre, and that will have a higher potential to reach more of an audience. And I can go and do that. And I think that's kind of his realization, is he's realizing, look, these movies aren't connecting. They're not being seen. Indie's not indie. Distribution's a pain. Why am I doing this to myself?
I think he also decided not to keep pursuing kind of personal projects. I think that with Schizopolis, he got it out of his system. Mm-hmm. And we've spoken before about how he decided he wasn't really a writer. And that wasn't really going to be his role, that he was going to be a director.
Yeah. And there's something still, like, personal in all his stuff. You know, like, I don't know, like, we talk about putting his own craft into what he does. He also puts himself into what he does in a certain degree. You know, like, the Spalding Gray relationship is meaningful to him. Grey's Anatomy is meaningful to him. This film that he did is not just a work for hire. He could have treated it like that, even with his relationship. But like we said, he had a ton of flourishes to the movie. And in fact, we have another quote. This one's from the New York Times. And he says, when I saw Swimming to Cambodia, I had the sensation that I assume a lot of people did, that my mind works like that too. The constant spinning and digressing and organizing seemed so genuine. I identified with the struggle to filter experience in such a way that at least seems to make sense, which is an ongoing, sometimes futile process.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. It's sort of like working with Gray is part of Soderbergh's process of making sense of his own creative process.
Yeah.
And he remained interested in Gray's work and life, too. 6 years after Gray's death in 2010, Soderbergh released a documentary called And Everything is Going Fine. Apparently, he imagined it as Gray's final monologue. It's made entirely of Gray's performances, TV interviews, and home movies. To refer to Amy Taubin again, who wrote the Criterion notes for Grey's Anatomy, she has a couple of great insights that I'd like to close with. She says, the strategy of turning the screen into a hallucinatory, psychodramatic space carries over from Schizopolis to Grey's Anatomy, which I thought was a pretty interesting point,
mm-hmm.
and maybe argues for it as an actual Soderbergh film. And finally, she says, similarly prolific, Soderbergh and Grey could be two sides of the same coin in terms of their creative processes. Grey always dug in the same hole, but from slightly different angles. Or, to put it less metaphorically, he discovered in each succeeding piece that new experiences inevitably churned up and were filtered through the same trove of childhood memories. Grey was the opposite of a character actor, although he could be an excellent mimic for a moment or two when he wanted to evoke an encounter between himself and someone else within a first-person monologue in which he always played Spalding. Soderbergh, on the other hand, is the ultimate anti-auteurist auteur, determined never to repeat himself or anyone else.
I absolutely love that final line. That's so accurate and so much of what we've been talking about since the very start. And it's also, I think, a good note to end on. So if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and take a moment to give us a good rating or review on your platform of choice. Even better, tell a film-loving friend to join us on the journey to watch all the films of Steven Soderbergh. You can also follow us on Instagram at The Filmographers or on X at Filmographer Pod.
Special thanks to Kevin Lau, our producer, Gobson, who composed and played our theme music, and Cosmograph, who designed our logo and would be happy to design yours. If you have feedback, suggestions, or just want to share a fun Soderbergh fact, email us at thefilmographerspodcast@gmail.com.
Join us next week on the Filmographers Podcast for an episode I promise will be out of sight.
You would say that, Limey.